In the matter of State versus Anthony Miranda, can we please have appearances of counsel?
James K. Smith, Jr., Assistant Deputy Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Anthony Miranda.
Good morning. Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jason LaBeouf of Ziegler & Resnick on behalf of Amicus Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Monica Duartero, Assistant Monmouth County Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
Welcome. Welcome back in some cases from yesterday's arguments. Mr. Smith, please go ahead.
May it please the court, Your Honor, with the permission of the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Okay, this case, of course, is about third-party consent to search. Our position, very simply, is that a police officer cannot rely upon a third party's consent to search unless that officer reasonably believes that the third party has, quote, common authority over the premises. The state does not disagree with that position, which, of course, comes directly from Illinois versus Rodriguez. In this case, the judge did not find that ND and her children had common authority over the trailer. And the state has never argued that either ND or her children did have actual authority. They did not own or lease the storage trailer. They did not say that the landlord had given them permission to store items in the trailer, and they did not say the defendant had done so.
Didn't ND's daughter say they let us keep some of our stuff in the trailer because there's so much of it?
The first part, they let us. I did not hear that, and it's not in the transcript. In terms of storing the stuff in the trailer, yes, she says we have our stuff stored in there, yes.
So in terms of the transcript issue, I guess that raises an issue with the transcript in general, where it seems that there are many ways in which the transcript is not correct if you're watching the video. It was someone attempting to transcribe the video while the video was playing in court, correct?
Correct.
And so in that circumstance, are we supposed to rely on the transcript even if it's incorrect when watching or listening to the video, or are we supposed to rely on the video?
Well, as this court has said in the SS case, of course, the first person that gets to decide what's in the video is the trial judge. And that this case was decided based in the appellate division and at the trial level, based upon what was everyone heard. This DVD was, in fact, played before the judge, and the judge did not find that the DVD said that the ND had been allowed to, and I'm trying to quote your language, allowed to put stuff there.
It was just they let us keep some of our stuff in the trailer because there's so much of it.
The judge did not, in his opinion, as I remember it, base any part of his opinion on the they let us language. He based it on they said that they all had items stored in the trailer.
Is the transcript accurate?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. That I went through this transcript I went through the DVD and compared it to the transcript, and I played the DVD as loud as I could play it, and I certainly found a number of words and a couple of short sentences which were not transcribed.
Should we remand to settle the record?
I don't know that there is really a dispute about the record, in the sense that the state's argument at the trial level and on appeal and before this court is simply that having access to the trailer was sufficient in order for ND and her family to give consent based upon a theory of apparent authority.
But you started your argument talking about facts that you say were missing that would have, if existing, supported a finding of apparent authority. And one of those, as Justice Wehner Apter pointed out, may be in the DVD and not in the transcript. I mean, aren't we dealing with potentially? I'm sure you, knowing you, Mr. Smith, you're going to have an argument on each fact as it appears, and always persuasive. But the fact is, the DVD versus the transcript really may change the picture in some direction or another.
Well, my argument would be that it's too late to change the picture, okay? That this was played in court twice, once at the first hearing and once at the second hearing. The judge listened to it. He made his decision, and he made a decision not upon what he, may or may not have heard, but on a matter of law, and that is that simply having access to the trailer is sufficient in order to give comment authority.
But just to clarify, you're saying the judge made his decision based on watching the video twice, not based on the incorrect transcript.
Well, that's correct. Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
This is a different situation in that you didn't have the parties hand back and forth to one another a draft transcript and make improvements. This is, as Justice Wehner Apter pointed out, simply a transcription by the stenographer in court, the court reporter. We are to work off of what?
The judge's findings. That if I understand the SS opinion correctly.
And courts are, of course, on appellate review to look at the basis for a judge's findings. To conduct that analysis, what should we be looking at?
Well, I think that you should be looking at the reason why the judge, in fact, denied the motion to suppress. That, possibly there have been other stuff in the case that the judge either heard and did not consider or didn't even hear.
But shouldn't we find out what was said, figure out what was said with the assistance of the parties? Because what was said, this is obviously very, and the way you started your argument reflects that. This is very fact sensitive. And the interaction between the officer or the officers and the individuals in that family at that moment are really quite critical.
They are very fact sensitive,
shouldn't we be working off at least a completed record, not the result of a court stenographer who was struggling to keep up with a DVD as it's playing, that really reflects what was said and by whom?
Well, I respectfully have to disagree with that, Your Honor, because the judge did not base his decision based upon the transcript, which of course wasn't prepared until, we started this appeal process. He based his decision on what he heard and upon his understanding of the law.
So to follow up on the Chief's question, what should we be relying on?
The judge's findings, which I believe I've said before.
So the findings, as I think the Chief mentioned, this court normally upholds factual findings if it is based on sufficient credible evidence in the record. So we look at what those findings were based on with regard to the video or the transcript. What should we be relying on to determine whether the court's factual findings were based on sufficient credible evidence?
Well, first of all, the state in this case has not argued that there were other facts in the record or that were inconsistent with the findings made by the trial judge.
But you previously said that the judge's findings were based on the video and not based on the transcript, correct? The judge did not have access to the transcript, and so the judge's findings could not have been based on the transcript, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so if we're trying to understand whether there is substantial evidence to support the judge's findings, we would need to look at the video and not the transcript, correct?
That's correct. If the state were up here arguing that, in fact, the judge's findings were incorrect, then that would come into play, but that hasn't happened.
Well, let's take an example, Mr. Smith. We know from SS that if the video evidence clearly undermines the judge's findings or the party's assumptions, then the court does, on appeal, does have the prerogative to decide differently or remand for a correction of the record. SS does leave open that possibility, right?
Yes.
All right. So as one example, it seems like there was a misunderstanding or misattribution of who was walking with Officer Roxby from the trailer 90 to 99. Looks like folks thought it was, ND herself. It was the sister, it seems, by the footwear and so on. So if there's mistaken factual predicates, doesn't SS authorize this court to have that reexamined by the trial court?
Well, certainly this court has that, ability to do so. There's no question.
Is there something problematic, as you think through this issue with us, for the court to remand for a settling of the record and the development of a more accurate transcript?
Well, there is one sort of non-legal factor in all of this, and that is that Mr. Miranda will max out on his sentence on February 23rd, 2023. And he will not be under parole or under any other form of court supervision, so he could take off for parts unknown. So
how long would it take for the parties to present an agreed upon transcript to the trial court and have that sent back to this court?
I'm not sure the parties can agree upon a what's in the transcript, because having read it, listened to it myself so often, I'm not sure that that could happen.
How long would it take for the parties to agree to the extent they can and flag any differences for the trial court? It's not a terribly long transcript. It seems like it could be done in a matter of weeks.
No? Well, certainly. We're dealing with a trial judge, as you know, who I believe is still on the court, and it could be done as quickly as the judge resolves to do it.
Please go ahead with
that. Okay. Let me just say also that let us assume that the ND or her sister or one of her children said the landlord allows us to put it there, or even one step more, says, oh, the landlord gave us permission to keep stuff there. Well, in Illinois versus Rodriguez, of course, you had a situation where the girlfriend says, this is our apartment, and I have, stuff there, and not only that, but I have the key, and I'm going to let the police into the apartment. The Supreme Court of the United States did not find that that alone gave her apparent authority. And I've seen cases say that, it stands for the proposition that she had apparent authority. No, it doesn't. What they did was they remanded it back to the Illinois courts, because so they said there's other stuff in the record here, and that is, of course, the fact that the girlfriend had moved out of the apartment and she'd taken some of her possessions. So this, apparent authority question is not resolved simply by a statement by ND or her children that, oh, the landlord gave us permission. We don't know who the landlord was. The prosecutor in their brief that they filed in response to the motion to suppress said that defendant said that he received permission from the superintendent of the Shadow Lake Lawn Trailer Park to place his mother's belongings in 99 Laurel Drive, which was unopened. Okay, so that's one of the uncontested facts which they have. That's in the appendix to my appellate division brief, page 49. They also say, and just to be completely candid with the court, at page 57, they say that MD and defendant were afforded the benefit of storing personal items there. But, you know, my position, again, is just saying that we have permission is not enough. That even if you say that, you know, the landlord gave us permission, that Illinois versus Rodriguez says that in an ambiguous circumstance, the police have an obligation to conduct further inquiries, which, of course, in this situation would have been, well, who's the landlord? Who gave you permission? Who gave you the key? Where did you have the key? You know, all of those questions were completely unanswered.
From the perspective of the officer, so he has Endy and her children come to the police station and they show these text messages which refer to the defendant being in her house. And then they go to what they believe to be Endy's house at 90 Laurel, or Endy's trailer at 90 Laurel, and they find defendant in it, and he comes out and he's arrested. And then one of her children says, perhaps they let us keep some of our stuff in the trailer, referring to 99, because there's so much in it. So from the officer's perspective, he believes 90 belongs to ND and that defendant was living there with her or was in it at the time that he found defendant. And then he hears a child of ND say, you know, they're also letting us keep stuff somewhere else. Why would the on what basis would the officer believe that defendant owned it instead of ND if he believed that ND owned 90 and defendant was in 90?
Well, I don't believe that anybody believed the defendant owned 90. There was a question of who had gotten permission to use that space. It was obviously there was a unnamed landlord who, in fact, either owned the building or certainly had control over it. And so the question was who got permission. Let me keep going here, if I may. I think it's important to understand that the apparent authority doctrine relies on mistakes of fact and not mistakes of law. That in this case, Captain Roxby made a mistake of law because he believed that just storing items in the storage trailer was sufficient to give ND and her children authority to consent. Our position, of course, under Illinois versus Rodriguez is access alone does not establish common authority. And if I could give the court a hypothetical, okay? My one neighbor has a really nice large garden shed, and I'm jealous, but in any event, suppose, hypothetically, I went to her and said, my garage is full of stuff. Do you mind if I put a few things in your garden shed? And she's a nice lady, and she says, oh, yeah, okay, go ahead and do it. Well, obviously, I would have a certain degree of access to that garden shed because I'm putting items in and maybe taking them out. And I don't think it would matter, really, whether I had to ask her for the key or whether it was kept unlocked or whatever. The fact is, it's her garden shed. But if the police come to me and say, hey, you know, we heard that you had some items stored in that garden shed, and we'd like to take a look inside.
I think you'd be on to them. I think you would be on to what they were going
to do. Well, yes. Okay, but my response would be, it's not my garden shed. I don't have any authority that says who's to go in and comes out. That, you know, it belongs to her. You got to ask her for consent. So, and I would say this, that let's assume that all of this stuff about access to the shed is, but I assume I lose on all of that, okay? Well, the next item is the black bag inside. And it's a sealed black bag. Captain Roxby says that he opened it, right?
How was it sealed? Can you describe a little bit more about the condition of the bag?
I don't know any more than it's on the tape. You know, all I know is that it's closed in some manner because he said that he opened it. Okay? That
was it separate and apart from other items in the shed?
It appeared to me, just from my seeing of the video, it seemed like it was sitting on top of a table or something like that. But in any event, that there's no claim of common authority over the bag, no claim of access to it. The ND said, told Roxby that she was scared of the guns. So this case falls right under this court's decision in State versus Suazo. And the state, in this instance, does not argue that there was apparent authority to consent to a search. Their argument is exigent circumstances. But there were no exigent circumstances because they take the bag, they leave the trailer, they lock the door, and defendants locked up in jail. So there. Also, the state in their brief criticizes me for suggesting that the romantic relationship between ND and defendant was over. Now, I think that my argument there is very well supported by the record because, you know, the woman had filed domestic violence charges against the defendant. She had him arrested. You had evidence of this, these text messages going back and forth 10 weeks earlier, which, you know, were very, very hateful between the two of them, and whatever. But
according to those same text messages, 90 Laurel was ND's trailer, not defendant's, and defendant was still living in it. So even if they were having a contentious relationship or even if they had broken up, defendant was still living in ND's home.
Absolutely.
And they found defendant in ND's home that morning.
Absolutely. Correct.
So why would them having broken up be relevant to whether the police would think that ND had authority over the premises, either 90 or 99, if they believed 90 was her home?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, that it appeared to me at least, and maybe it doesn't have any relevance, but it appeared to me at least that Captain Roxby took into account the fact that there had been this relationship between the two. And it's really the state that's arguing that the romantic relationship is significant. That answers your question. But in any event, the relationship was over, and there's no romantic relationship exception to the consent requirement that just being a girlfriend does not equal common authority. I would notice there's also a second aspect to the appellate division opinion, which I would like to discuss briefly. The trial judge found, and the appellate division cited, the fact that the trial judge found that defendant had a lower expectation of privacy with respect to his belongings in the storage trailer because the main door was unlocked and open. And then there's language about the defendant assumed the risk that another individual would consent. So that language was come straight out of United States versus Matlick, but it refers to people who have common authority, or, you know, Matlick, it was not an apparent authority case, it was an actual authority case. And what it says is that where there is, you know, joint control, that you assume the risk that somebody else is going to consent. If I have a storage locker with another person and we both put stuff in there and we have keys, I, of course, assume the risk that that other person is going to give consent to someone to come into the storage locker. So also, You have, I would say here, that the one item where I do take exception to the trial judge's findings was this finding that the screen door was unlocked and closed, but the main door was unlocked and open. Now, that the fact is that you have Roxby's testimony that he didn't know if a key had been used to secure the trailer, and if so, who had unlocked it. You have the tape says that ND tells Roxby that her sister went to open up the shed, and then of course you have the fact that the shed was locked up after they all left. But in any event, my position, of course, is that it doesn't matter whether or not the thing was locked because the screen door was closed. And my argument, of course, is the fact that if you open your main door of your house and just let air come in through the screen door, that in fact you are not inviting anyone into the house or even giving them permission to do so. So that would be my argument. Again, I'll close simply by saying that I think that Captain Roxby here was faced with a somewhat ambiguous situation, and that under Illinois versus Rodriguez, what he should have done and didn't do was ask some questions. Like, well, you know, who gave you the right to put you have your stuff in? Who told you that was okay to do that? Did the defendant say it, or was it somebody else? Those kind of questions went completely unanswered. And as this court said in State versus Cushing, where the record has holes, that inures to the benefit of the defendant. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Shalom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'll start by addressing your question, Chief Justice Rabner, about why not simply remand it. There's no doubt that there are bits and bobs in that transcript that don't match up to the DVD. That can't be disputed. I think the answers are twofold. Mr. Smith talked about the harm to his client and parole eligibility. I mean, the point is, time is a-wasting and Mr. Miranda is in prison. But I think ultimately the reason is, even if we accept as absolutely true the portion that Justice Wiener Apter read, they told us we could keep things in there because we had so much stuff, in rough paraphrase. That is still woefully insufficient to show apparent authority for a couple reasons. We never learn who they is, and that's important, who they is, but it still focuses on property, whose stuff is where, rather than access and control. And the wrong question begets the wrong answer, or begets an answer that is worth nothing. If I may give a non-hypothetical example here, my in-laws live in an apartment in New York City, and they're moving. And because people are coming into their apartment, they wanted to get little tchotchkes off of their shelves, family pictures, artwork, things. So there are a couple boxes.
All those pictures they keep of you.
Of me. They were embarrassed by them, so they wanted to get them off of their shelves. And they boxed them up, and they're currently storing them in my basement. There is no doubt that they, meaning my wife and I, have given them permission to leave stuff in our basement. But that doesn't get to the critical question on consent to search, which is, do they have access and control for most purposes?
And the record is— What about that statement in combination with ND having a key, if indeed she had a key?
Also irrelevant, because in the ways that we know keys are not dispositive. My in-laws, in fact, have a key to my home in case we get locked out. But that doesn't mean they have access and control. And there could have been clarifying questions asked by Captain Roxby that would have gotten us there. But the record, even the record viewed in the light most favorable to the state, the record that Justice Wiener Apter read, would not answer any of those critical questions.
Why not find out what the record is? I mean, this is. I can't think of an area of law that relies more intensely on what
facts
may seem to be minor facts than this area of the law.
Justice Patterson, I don't disagree with that as a general principle, that we would like a correct record. But let me give you a another example from this transcript. I was listening to it last night with my child, who had better ears than me. I was hoping she was going to find some discrepancies. And there are tons. There are places where it says inaudible when, in fact, it's audible. And if any of those could change the legal analysis, I would say, of course, we need to remand to correct those. But if none of them could be dispositive, then I don't think there's an inherent harm in correcting the record. Though, to be clear, I want to just focus on what we'd be talking about. It would be saying what was on the record that the trial judge heard. It would not invite an opportunity for the state to call ND or anything like that. It would be the record as was before, because, of course, the state had the burden, and if they failed to meet it, that's that. But there's not an inherent harm in it, but I do think there is a legal question in this case that could be answered in the same way summary judgment motions are viewed, which is if we...
Let's jump to the merits.
That is my fundamental point on point one, which is the question is about authority and control, not about property. And the officer here asked a lot of times, lots of questions about, do you keep stuff here? I mean, mostly this was with respect to the car rather than the shed, but it was both. And that's the wrong question. And whatever the answer to that is, it's not going to get us where we need to go.
But in terms of authority and control, so the police arrive, as I said, thinking it's ND's home, and they find the defendant in it.
Yes.
And then eventually ND and her children come, and then the sister also comes, and ND, the children, the sister raise, oh, there's this other place also, there's a shed, there's another trailer, and we have stuff in there. So if the police are starting from the knowledge that 90 is ND's home, and defendant is inside of it, and then ND and her relatives say there's also these other places where we have stuff, why would the police not think that those other places either belong to ND or that ND had access to them?
Justice Wainwright, I think that gets to one of the questions in this case, which is, are we treating trailer homes differently than we treat other single family homes? My address is 332. If you found out that there was something, that I kept something at 340, I think that whatever, 341, whatever it is, nine house numbers away, you wouldn't say, well, we assume that's Alex's. You, of course, wouldn't make that assumption. It's a separate place.
But here it's more that no one had suggested that defendant had a separate home that he owned and that only he resided in, and that was number 99. Defendant was found in ND's home.
At 90, where everyone agreed he was residing, or they expected him to be residing, which is why they went there to arrest him. But I think the opposite is what's important here, Justice Wainwright, which is no one suggested that ND lived at 99.
If you were down the road from a storage facility, then the exact same, which is close to your home.
Right.
This has nothing to do with trailer versus non-trailer. It's a storage facility that is very close to her home.
Respectfully, Justice Patterson, I don't agree. I think it is a home that is being used as a storage facility.
It's an empty home that is being used as a storage facility.
And if my neighbors had moved and I was storing stuff in their home, no one would expect...
That's why they moved.
Exactly, right. No one would expect that the police could simply enter it on the assumption that its proximity to my home and my stuff was sufficient.
And that's not all that's in this case.
I actually think it is all that's in it with respect to what Captain Rigsby knew about ND's nexus to 99.
Could we avoid these problems with the record concerning the trailer and the legal issues concerning the trailer by focusing, as we got to the end of Mr. Smith's argument, on the bag?
Yes.
Aren't there important constitutional questions raised by just emptying out the contents of a bag, given the record we have about the ownership of the bag, and the warrant, in fact, refers to a bag that was supposed to be at 99, not there.
I think that's right. That would be a way for the court to avoid the argument altogether. I agree with Mr. Smith's viewing of the video. I will say, when we look at the search of the car, which, of course, revealed no contraband, so it's not squarely at issue. But you can see there's a very thorough going through of lots of bags of power tool boxes. I mean, there are containers that are being opened with up and down. I think that is a way.
I have a question then about containers, because you could also see in the beginning of the video, before ND and her children arrive, that there's a very thorough search of 90. So it's not just a search of the front hall closet that the bag was supposed to be in. There's opening of dresser drawers, there's opening of the refrigerator, there's opening of cabinets, there's a lot of opening.
Right.
What counts as a container? Is a dresser drawer a container? Is a cabinet a container?
I think both are containers, and I think that the traditional way we think about where you can look in a search warrant, most search warrants will say, and all containers therein, and that it doesn't actually mean that. It means all containers therein where the contraband could be stored, right? So if the contraband is a dead body, then a box this size, a box, a key box would be insufficient, but if you're looking for cocaine, you'd have a much wider berth. But if it doesn't say all containers, I think everything that you just described would count as a container, a dresser drawer, a box, a bag, a cabinet. I want to be clear, Judge Sabatino, that while the bag analysis would be a way to shortcut the remand and prevent getting to the consent legal issue, the open door, which both the appellate division and the trial court seem to rely on, and I think there's some factual problems with whether the door was open, is also an insufficient legal basis to find a diminished expectation of privacy. And again, I think that is a place where I fear a differential treatment in rich neighborhoods than in poor neighborhoods. I often will leave my door open for a nice breeze, and that does not invite the police in. It doesn't invite anyone in, but it certainly doesn't invite the police in. I think we have a long line of jurisprudence.
You said factual problems. What are they?
I think Mr. Smith alluded to them. My brief also mentions them. There's at some point, Captain Rigsby says, where is she? Someone says, and there's a debate as to whether it's ND or her sister says, who, my sister? Because obviously they're sisters with one another. She's opening the shed. So there's no doubt that when Captain Rigsby gets there, the door is open. But it may have been opened 30 seconds earlier. And that obviously matters a lot on the facts, but I don't think it matters on the law, because people can leave their door open without inviting the public in, and certainly without inviting the police in. Our line of cases, including Stott and Hempel, make clear that even inviting the public in doesn't mean you're inviting law enforcement in. And what's important here also is, remember that Mr. Miranda was home until he got arrested. So it's not to say that he goes to work, he leaves for a week and leaves the door open and unlocked. It's while he was home, at worst, while he was home, the door was opened and unlocked. Unless the court has other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom.
Thank you.
I'd like to see if we can try to finish this argument before the lunch break. Mr. LeBuck?
Your Honor, the concern of Amicus, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in this case, is that it seems to be, I don't want to say lost, but it hasn't really been mentioned that what we're talking about here is an exception to the warrant requirement. And what is really concerning to Amicus is we are talking about what should be the least accepted exception to the warrant requirement. Because quite often what you're faced with in a police-citizen encounter on the street is a situation where even if the person from whom consent is being sought is, for lack of a better word, an ally of the suspect, in the face of the stress of that situation, confronted by armed and uniformed law enforcement officers, more often than not, the will to refuse to grant consent is going to be overborne. And now you're entering a situation where...
Is there anything in either of these two sources on the record, the transcript or the DVD, that suggests that the officer overbore the will of ND or any member of her family?
No, Your Honor, and that's precisely what Amicus's concern is, because in this situation, she's not an ally of the suspect where her will would be willing to overborne. She wanted them to go anywhere they needed to go to find the guns. She was quite distraught about the fact that they didn't find them in the first place. And that is why it is concerning, because we're taking the exception to the warrant requirement
of consent, and we're allowing it to be somewhat expanded because ND did.
If you have another case where there's a suggestion, which is the scenario you're talking about, which is the suggestion is that there was, the consent was not freely given, you make that argument.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That's not in this case.
No, Judge, but what we have, Your Honor, what we have in this case is a situation where ND actually lacked actual authority, and it is the argument of amicus, lacked apparent authority. Because what drove Captain Roxby in this case, Your Honor, by his own words were, quote, attempting to look in any place that I thought the guns may have been.
How do we know that she lacked actual authority? What evidence is there in the record? I know there was a letter that was sent by defense counsel asserting at some point that defendant owned 99 or had sole permission to be using 99, but did that ever make it into the record? What evidence is there in the record that only defendant owned or had access to 99 such that ND did not have actual authority over 99?
Well, Justice, I think the issue is that Captain Roxby did a haphazard investigation into finding out whether or not she actually had apparent authority.
I know, but I asked about actual authority because you had first mentioned actual. So I'm leaving apparent to the side and I'm trying to get at actual.
There is nothing in the record to suggest that ND had actual authority. In fact, Judge Justice, all of the facts that are on this record suggest the opposite.
So
and I know Your Honor had raised concerns about if she was the actual owner of 90, does that impute some sort of suggestion by inference to Captain Roxby that gave her ready authority, as Mr. Shalom argued, over 90, and it doesn't. 99 and 90, they're different. They're different structures. In fact, the search warrant for, ironically, the place where she might have actually had actual authority only covered 90. It didn't cover 99. And then we take all of these other facts that Captain Roxby was well-versed on. The text message, it's over. It has been for quite a while.
But I think what Justice Wiener-Apter is asking was, what are the facts that you're relying on, if I'm correct, to say that there was no actual authority?
Over 99.
Over 99.
Well, I think that's the point, Your Honors. It was the state's burden and Captain Roxby's duty to get those facts, and he didn't do that. There are no facts. There are no facts that she had actual authority of 99. And the reason there are no facts is because Captain Roxby was going to attempt to look in any place I thought the guns may have been, and he did a shoddy investigation. He was required to gather more information, or what amicus would actually prefer, you have a defendant who's far away in a holding cell in the Highlands Police Department awaiting transport to the Monmouth County Jail. The structure is secure. Putting aside the bag issue for a second, the bag is secure. There was nothing to stop Captain Roxby from obtaining a warrant. Facts developed while he was at the scene that were not known to him when he obtained the original warrant that required him to obtain a new warrant.
We wouldn't be here. But what we have here is a warrantless search in which the state's assertion was there was apparent authority. So that's our issue.
Absolutely, Justice. And it's the concern of amicus that the more discretion we are giving to law enforcement in these citizen police encounters, the more we are going to be here having to answer these questions when what the law actually requires is obtaining a warrant. That is the fundamental constitutional right that has been abridged here. And had Captain Roxby done that, your Honor is quite correct, we wouldn't be here. And that's what amicus would prefer to see on the street when we're talking about these citizen police encounters.
We have your position, I think. Is there anything in addition you'd like to present?
Judge, I would just echo Mr. Shalom and Mr. Smith's sentiment with regard to the bag. Even if she had apparent authority to let them into 99, that does not cover the defendant's belongings that are in containers included that are within that structure. And with that, Your Honor, amicus would just ask that you reverse the lower court.
Thank you, Ms. Blua.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Duotera, I'm sorry for rushing you a little bit.
I want to start with answering the questions with regard to the audio recording versus the transcript. The state would actually agree with Mr. Smith that if the court were to decide this on this record, that the court would have to rely on the video recording and not the transcript. The video recording is what Judge Lemieux reviewed. It's also what is in evidence. I'm sure the assistant prosecutor who tried this case is screaming at her computer right now. The state would not object to a remand. I can assure the court that any remand would take place before the end of this year, as that assistant prosecutor is retiring this coming month in December. Additionally, Judge Lemieux is a very speedy judge with regard to his calendar, and I can pretty much assure the court that it would be completed with all due haste. I believe this is an issue that comes up. I know the court referenced stenographers. I double-checked the transcript. This is an issue that's created because we didn't have stenographers in the courtroom, and you do have people listening to, or transcribers afterwards listening to audio recordings. This is maybe the second case I've had before this court, this calendar year, I believe, that's had issues where what's on audio recordings is mistranscribed by a transcriber. I'm not here, obviously, to tell this court what to do, but it might be a situation where going forward, we need an amendment to a court rule or something that directs that audio recordings moved into evidence be transmitted to transcribers so that they can listen to the original instead of trying to transcribe it through court microphones. To address the legal arguments being raised, again, I don't disagree with Mr. Smith that we're starting from a legal framework that's well established with regard to apparent authority that asks what are reasonable, with the facts available to an officer at the moment warrant a man of reasonable caution and the belief that the consenting party had authority over the premises, that this is an objective test based on the totality of circumstances known to the officer at the time of the search. The state submits that what was known to Captain Roxby at the time of the search here, as found by both the Law Division and the Appellate Division, did provide that objectively reasonable belief. And I don't want to belabor facts that have been mentioned by the bench during prior arguments, but the officer knew that the defendant and the victim were cohabitating regardless of what those text messages were previously. Those text messages also made clear what defendant thought of the victim's trailer and the disdain he had at that point. Nonetheless, when the officers went to arrest the defendant, he was in that residence, and the search of the residence that was conducted pursuant to the TRO made clear that the cohabitation had resumed. Officer also knew that there were statements from the victim and from her children that were corroborated by pictures and text messages that were relied upon by Judge Smith to issue a TRO to grant authorization to search 90 Laurel for the guns, and were also supportive of probable cause for the criminal charges issued here. He had before him people that later report to him that they store their stuff at 99 Laurel that had already been deemed credible enough for a judge. And I think that is important. He knew the victim and the family were very invested in finding guns due to their fear of defendant. There are numerous times on the video where you can see them assisting in the search. And just to correct Mr. Shalom briefly, he, I think, is confusing the shed with the storage trailer. I think it's clear when you watch, I think, and part of the audio or of the video recording that was identified by Judge Sabatino earlier, that the officer's talking to the sister, and it's that the sister's opening the shed, and when she comes back to the storage trailer, 99 Laurel, she actually makes clear, and this is at 3334, and thereafter in the audio recording, that she's been to the shed and searched the shed. So any unlocking and searching is in relation to that shed, and I would submit not with regard to 99 Laurel. I don't think it's clear in the record how that is open, how long it's open. What we do know, or what Captain Roxby knows, is that when he gets there, that the door is open. And I think that does matter. The state's not saying, and I think it's a mischaracterization of the lower courts to say that that fact was relied upon as somehow dispositive, but it is a fact that matters, because when you're looking at all of the other facts that the captain knew that they were, again, representing that this was a shared storage area where they all kept stuff. It's not like when he got there, he sees a sign on the door that says Anthony Miranda's only, you know, do not enter, right? That then we would be questioning whether it was reasonable for the officer to believe the victim's apparent authority. And again, so it's just a factor. It's not dispositive. The state is not arguing, nor would it argue that somehow having your door open but your storm door closed to allow air in is allowing officers to enter a residence. I think what the defendant's asking this court to do with regard to this, I guess what they're saying ultimately is Captain Roxby should have done more. The state would submit that in practice, that would be asking this court to essentially write out apparent authority, right? I mean, one of the suggestions in the brief is that they should have called the landlord, but then at that point, it's not apparent authority anymore, it's actual authority, right? Apparent authority is about the reasonableness and the objectiveness of the belief. State also takes issue with another example of what they claim Captain Roxby should have done, which is call the defendant. In a DV situation, I can't think of anything that is more problematic than asking officers not to believe the victim and to call her abuser and ask him whether or not he owns the storage shed or he has the authority to with regard to the storage shed. Specifically,
yes, right now we're with your former partner and we're looking for your guns.
Yeah, I think beyond that, too, I think we're getting into a weird issue that kind of asks for a rule that is hard to resolve with Georgia versus Randolph. And I would submit, I believe, which this court adopted in State versus Lamb. I'm unfortunately case name full at the moment, where when you're talking about actual authority, and the reality is all apparent authority to the officer at the scene is actual authority, right? He believes it. It later turns out to be not true. In Georgia versus Randolph, where you have actual co-occupants and the one occupant is removed from the scene lawfully, we don't require law enforcement to go to that person and ask them whether or not they will consent to the search. But saying that the captain here, in the face of all this evidence that the state would submit is sufficient to make his belief objectively reasonable, that he would have to contact the defendant to confirm that, I think is, again, hard to resolve with Georgia versus Randolph when you wouldn't even have to call him and get his consent anyway. Ultimately, the state's
argument why after Captain Roxby found the bag, he did not need to get a warrant to search it and could just open it up and search it right then.
I think the state's position on this is clear. We are not arguing that it fell under her consent to search. There's plenty of case law that talks about in the car search context that the driver or the owner of a vehicle can't consent to a search of a passenger's bag. I mean, it's always been represented in this case that it was the defendant's bag. The state's position as laid out in its brief, and I'm happy to go through it if the court wants me to, is that it was exigent circumstances at this point. All of the factors that we mentioned, that I mentioned up into this point, giving him the objective belief, plus I think the clear evidence of record with regard to the lack of officers on duty, the lack of ability to get another officer in to assist. I mean, Captain Roxby's testimony is clear that it was himself and the detective that was processing the defendant or the owner. Oh, dear.
Wouldn't that justify an exception for every search in a municipality, a town that has a limited number of officers?
I wouldn't suggest in all circumstances. I do suggest in this circumstance, because it's not just, I mean, there's the argument that they could have locked the trailer, but we know from this video.
Stay with the staffing issue for a second. Mm-hmm. That's one of the bases that you're relying upon. How many officers in this township?
Total, I'm not sure. I do know that there was two on duty, and that is what is of record. What's also of record is the officer was asked, the captain was asked if there was the ability to call anybody out, like off duty to come in, and he testified that that would take, I think he was kind of dismissive about the idea in general because funding issues, but also that it would take an hour. Ultimately, the detective was with the defendant processing. The defendant was ultimately going to have to take the defendant to county jail. That has to be done expeditiously under criminal justice reform. I also think what's important here, and I think why it's not every single case, is because you do have the facts where he's presented with a victim and her family that also have access to that trailer. We know from the video, she states that she has a key. They're also very invested. I think what the video makes clear, they're very invested in finding this gun. And so I don't think there's this isn't a situation, I think, that it would be reasonable for the officer to have just, you know, locked it up and gotten a warrant, because he has all of these people that have access to it and are going to.
But aside from locking it up, staying there, securing the trailer for an hour, is that what you said?
He said it would be an hour.
An hour.
Mm-hmm. But he was the
secure
only.
Stand there, secure the trailer for an hour and get a warrant.
But I think that's where
is that exigent?
Well, that's where we get back to staffing issues, because the officer didn't know that he would be able to stand there for an hour. He testified that he was the only other officer available to answer any other call for service.
Isn't that sort of a potential exigency as opposed to actual? Had he gotten a call 30 minutes into the attempt to get a warrant, maybe the situation would have been different.
I mean, I think this is an actual exigency. I think it's actual exigency based on this court's decision in Zalkberg. There, it was a blood draw warrant. The officer went to the hospital to obtain the blood draw. We know now, after the fact, that the officer waited for over an hour to get access to the defendant, but this court said that that was still exigency, because even though we now knew that there was an hour that the officer waited, the officer didn't know that's how long he would have to wait. So I think, and I'm not saying that this town all the time staffing issues, I'm saying in this case, again, being a DV situation, being a situation where you had a family that was actively invested in finding the gun. I mean, this isn't just about keeping the defendant from getting the gun. I think it's law enforcement's obligation to prevent the victim and her family from accessing the gun. You can see clearly on the video that the officer is making the gun safe. All officers do that when encountering guns. We don't know that the victim or her family would do that. I didn't cite it in my brief because it's a community caretaking case, and we all know that that does not exist anymore after the United States Supreme Court's decision. But we do have a case in New Jersey that talks about a landlord that finds a gun and calls the police, and they tell her to just leave it, and she says, well, I'm going to get it anyway. And that was upheld. The police then go and get the gun. It was upheld on a community caretaking basis. But I think the logic applies here as well.
Is there a basis under the law for the officer to have taken the bag, secured it, gotten a warrant, and not open it until the warrant was obtained?
I think that that is a possibility, but I don't think that possibility here is reasonable. And this is why. Because the officer had been told, or had been led to believe, the victim was under the belief that the guns were in the bag and that the bag was in a closet in 90 Laurel Drive. Once the officer didn't find it there, I don't think it is reasonable for the officer to assume that the guns were, once they found the bag, that the guns were in there. I think it's probable and possible, but it might not be, right? If there was time for the defendant to move where the bag was, there was also time for the defendant to put the guns in another bag. So again, could the officer have done that? Yes, but what the officer could have done is not the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. It's if what the officer did here is reasonable. And I would suggest under these facts, and again, this is a very fact-specific argument that the state's making, that under these facts, based on this situation, again, DV, guns, victim's family looking for it, gun not where it initially was anticipated, that the officer's conduct here was reasonable.
These were all adults present, right? No children present.
But yeah, they were. My understanding is the victim's children were adult children. Unless the court has any questions. Thank you so much, Your Honors. Have a good day.
We're in a way yet. We want to hear from Mr. Smith.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint, Your Honors, but at this point, I think we've covered the agenda pretty well, and I will just submit unless there are any further questions from the court.
Nope, there are none.
Thank you.
I want to thank all counsel.